I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at Boston Sleet Center.
It's Here and Now. The Democratic Convention gets underway tonight, and Boston is as ready as it can be to host the almost 5,000 delegates, 15,000 credentialed representatives of the press, and another 15,000 or so invited guests who will be attending. That's a lot of visitors to a city with a population of not quite 600,000. Now, Robin, you're down there at the Fleet Center. What's the scene like now? Is there much activity yet?
Well, there is, but it's mostly journalists trying to plug in whatever it is they need to plug in. There seem to be hundreds of them. And, you know, Michael, you hear the word crackling a lot and you read it in the press accounts, and I think it's appropriate. There is a sort of a crackling energy at the Fleet Center, part nervousness, part a sense of, you know, this is the first convention post 9/11, the first ever in Boston, which, you know, given that politics is the lifeblood of the city, that's been shocking to many. But after weeks of, you know, legitimate worry about this convention, and moaning that some would say as a Boston birthright, it does seem as if everything is going smoothly, at least for now, and there's a lot of energy here.
Well, you mentioned that this is the first convention post 9/11. Is there a lot of security in evidence?
Yeah, well, there's some in evidence. We were noting that we saw what seemed to be snipers positioned. I mean, I have to stress, seem to be. They're at least uniformed officers positioned on the old elevated expressway that's being taken down. So they're up above near the Fleet Center with, you know, looking down, and they're very visible. It was reported over the weekend that F-16s would be flying over the city. And you get the sense of security, certainly at the Fleet Center, where I think one of the most difficult things is going to be getting in and out. There's lines of, you know, 100 journalists trying to get in certain entrances. It's set up sort of like an airport, you know, where you have to go through a screening. A colleague of ours, who will not be named, April, had to remove her underwire bra because it set off all sorts of alarms. And so, you know, there is a heightened sense of security. Seasoned journalists who have been through these things say they've never seen anything like it.
Well, tell us a bit more about what's happening in and around, say, the protest area.
Well, we are going to do that right now, as a matter of fact, Michael, because while we're on the topic of security, we're going to turn to WBUR's Martha Biebinger. She's just outside of the Fleet Center at a place the Boston police, Martha, are calling the free speech zone. But what are protesters calling it?
It works from there.
Oh, Michael, yeah.
You know something? They may be jamming her signals already. Now, that's what I call very heavyweight security.
Martha, jump in if you can. We're having trouble with your cell phone, but Michael, I just walked through that area to get into one of the entrances, and it does look like a pen. I mean, the protesters have apparently dubbed it Camp X-Ray because it's got this wired fencing with sort of a mesh screen on top of this pen area. And Martha, if you try again with your cell phone, but it doesn't seem as if many people are there.
There are not many people, maybe two dozen protesters right now who are
We'll get back to you. The amazing thing, Michael, is that there are cell phone trucks everywhere. It's the best cell phone coverage I've ever heard in Boston, except, of course, where Martha is. One last note. The sense of excitement is also because the celebrity quotient has gone through the roof. Poor Ben Affleck, the actor, used to be responsible for all of the celebrity-dom in the city of Boston, with maybe some members of Aerosmith thrown in. But I'm sure you saw the game last night, the Red Sox versus the Yankees, and there was John Kerry in the center.
I saw that. And, you know, Robin, that had to be one of the riskiest moves this risk-averse candidate has ever made, because he threw out the opening pitch at the Boston Yankees game last night. Now, what would have happened if the Red Sox had lost?
Well, they stepped to the plate, so to speak, and they won decidedly. There were a couple of triple home run thingies in there, and it was a really good night. Boston really shone last night under the lights of Fenway, and Democratic operatives are hoping that feeling continues throughout the week. But right now, we're waiting to see.
Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
According to a poll in today's Boston Globe, 95% of delegates at the convention oppose the war in Iraq. Yet the party platform deliberately avoids calling the war a mistake, instead saying, quote, people of goodwill disagree about whether America should have gone to war, and it goes on to say that we cannot afford to fail at peace, that we cannot allow a failed state in Iraq. Now, the platform will be voted on tomorrow, and with us on the line is someone who helped write the platform, Ohio Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones. Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine. Now,
good.
Was this a difficult part of the platform to shape, trying to get the right note, trying to reach a national audience and not just, you know, the core feeling of many activists in the Democratic Party?
Let me say this. The Democratic Party is very diverse, not only in its composition, but in its composition of thought. And the platform is a culmination of our chance that we had to get together, have a discussion, and figure out where do we come out best with statements that adequately reflect the diversity of the party. Clearly, there are a lot of people who now believe that the war was in an appropriate war. We went at an appropriate time, and I'm one of those. I was opposed to going to war in Iraq. But the reality of it is that we have thousands of young men and women that are young men and women over in a war in Iraq, over there fighting on for our freedom, and regardless of why we went in there, we now have to protect them and their interests and the interests of America. Some will say that it was a mistake. Others will say, well, we were misled. The information we received was inappropriate. But the reality is that is the platform we come up with, and we're expecting that the people at the convention will vote in our favor and that we'll move on.
Congressman, just tell us a bit about the process. You sit down as you're part of the platform committee. Are there a lot of representatives from Senator Kerry's staff who are saying, "Look, this is what the senator wants. He has to have the biggest voice here in the room."
Let me say this to you. What we did was we had hearings all across this country, four different locations where people had an opportunity to come and hear what our speaker said, to come and ask and provide questions for the speakers. After that, we drafted a platform. The platform was then sent out to all the 186 members of the platform committee. We had a hearing wherein they had the opportunity to offer amendments. There were some 200 amendments that were offered, some of the team from the Kerry campaign, some from the Democratic National Committee. I went to the people who offered their amendments to see if we could work out language that would satisfy their position on a particular issue.
Congresswoman, you're from Ohio. Now, there's some interesting polling news coming out of Ohio today showing Senator Kerry is beginning to open up some clear water with President Bush, especially if you don't factor in the Ralph Nader candidacy. What do you expect the voters of Ohio to come away with after the full 4 days of convention? Do you expect that Senator Kerry will continue to build on strengths there?
I expect that we will have the opportunity to show the people of Ohio all the strengths of this ticket, that in fact Ohio has lost a lot more than many other communities across this country. We've lost 205,000 jobs since George Bush took office. 60,000 of those jobs were lost in the city of Cleveland alone.
The thing about writing a platform now for the middle of the summer is that the thing that's become clear about the situation in Iraq is that it's extraordinarily fluid, and that statements and points of view that you might arrive at today in 90 days, 120 days, when the nation goes to the polls, might be outdated. Was that ever a concern?
It was not a concern when we wrote the platform, but the fact is, the reason it is fluid is because the administration did not have policies in place for us to have an exit strategy or a plan for how we got out of Iraq. And we're going to have to live with the fact that we're in that situation, and I just trust that the people of America will understand that Senator Kerry and Senator Edwards offer the best response for us to be strong at home and respected in the world.
Congresswoman Jones, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and invite me back again sometime.
Ohio Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones.
Well, Democratic operatives are swarming the Fleet Center looking to set out their candidates' agenda. We spoke this morning to Richard Morningstar. Now, he's former ambassador to the European Union during the Clinton administration and a current advisor to the Kerry campaign on issues of foreign policy. We asked him how a Kerry trade policy would differ from that of President Bush.
What will change in a Kerry administration is more of an emphasis on fairness to American workers, protecting American jobs, but at the same time recognizing our international obligations.
You're advising Senator Kerry broadly on foreign policy issues. He famously said that he'd talked to world leaders who said that it would be a better world if he were president than George Bush was president. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And Can you name any of the world leaders who have said that?
No, I'm not in a position to specifically name world leaders. I can tell you my experience, which has been principally in Europe. Talking both to many members of the European public as well as high-level European officials, not necessarily at the presidential or prime ministerial level, but high-level leaders that I have spoken to as well as the general public are almost universal in wanting to see a change in this administration. And that does come from personal knowledge. If this election were held in Europe, it would be a landslide. Obviously, it's not... obviously it's not being held in Europe.
Well, then how do you translate some of that for your candidate? I mean, how do you change the perception on the part of Americans that Senator Kerry might be great when it comes to health care and a lot of domestic issues, but if you look at the polls, as soon as it gets to security, the numbers flip, and it's President Bush that people have faith in?
I think that's going to change over the course, to the extent that that's the case, that's going to change over the course of the campaign. And I think that Senator Kerry feels very strongly, and I believe from my own personal experience, that it's important to engage better the various countries in the world and to gain cooperation on those issues that are of common interest.
We hear that the new Kerry mantra is stronger at home, respected abroad. What do you do about the number of people, undecideds in particular, and if you listen to talk radio, we hear on Radio Row, who say, you know what, I don't care what anyone thinks about me from France or Germany. I don't care. I don't care about that part of it. I just want to be safe.
I think the answer to that is to look at post-war Iraq. And look at how the United States has had to take such a huge amount of the burden in post-war Iraq. And I think the argument that he made to the American people is that if we cooperate, if we deal with the rest of the world with respect, we're more likely to get cooperation from them. We can't do everything alone. We can, yes. The United States can go in, and with 97% of the troops, the United States can invade Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein. But that's not the only part of it. We need to be able to cooperate in how to rebuild a country like Iraq. We need to be able to cooperate in dealing with the threat of terrorism. We need to be able to cooperate in post-war Afghanistan. We need to be able to cooperate with respect to non-proliferation. We need to be able to cooperate on global issues like the environment and like AIDS. And without dealing and without having a position of respect, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to do the things that we need to do.
In other words, it seems like he has to get across that respect can actually translate into saving American lives.
Absolutely. I agree, 100%.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Morningstar, former ambassador to the European Union and advisor to John Kerry. Well, stay with us. There's more live from Boston's Fleet Center coming up here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Well, one of the rising stars in the Democratic firmament has been tapped to speak tonight, Representative Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, the only openly lesbian member of Congress. We'll talk about health care. We caught up with a congresswoman on the Fleet Center floor yesterday. She was waiting to rehearse her speech as a gospel choir did a sound check, and we talked between bursts of song. Congresswoman Baldwin had fiercely fought a House bill which would keep federal courts from hearing challenges to state bans on same-sex marriage. Her candidate, John Kerry, supports states' rights, but Baldwin says that shouldn't eliminate the possibility of a challenge.
When I took to the floor last week, one of the things I said is this is no less than the specter of a sign on the courthouse door saying, you need not seek justice here. You need not seek equal protection here. And today this debate might be about gays and lesbians, but tomorrow this debate might be about somebody else.
Your candidate, John Kerry, and John Edwards as well, they're both personally against same-sex marriage. They say they prefer civil unions, but when all is said and done, they'll leave it up to the states. Isn't that confusing and conflicting? And would you rather hear a stronger statement pro same-sex marriage from them?
They've expressed both sentiments that, you know, if they were in charge, they would have a full array of equal benefits and responsibilities for gay and lesbian people in civil unions. They also believe that despite that being their personal opinions, that each state should be empowered to decide the issue themselves. So those aren't inconsistent views.
Only this cross to bear.
Well, as you well know, many of the delegates, the polls have been taken of the delegates to this convention. They support same-sex marriage. You obviously do. But what happens if your constituents don't? And you're an openly gay congresswoman.
Well, I think that this is a long process. Part of the effort here is to educate. And in the gay and lesbian community in particular, it's by having role models, by having people who are willing to be public to talk about their own lives or share their own lives or be role models in their professions.
I wonder, is that at times a burden for you? It's almost like you're the interpreter for a community to many of your colleagues. Do you become in danger of becoming the poster person for an issue or pigeonholed?
First of all, it's an incredible honor and privilege to be able to have a seat at the table and have access to my extraordinary colleagues who listen and we exchange and discuss and debate. And I feel like I have the privilege of being able to influence their opinions, not necessarily in a heated debate, but just as they get to know me and get to know my family.
Are you married?
No, Wisconsin doesn't recognize same-sex marriage.
Well, you've been in town for a couple of days here in Massachusetts.
No,
I wasn't sure.
I arrived today, but anyways, I have my motto is no proposal by press release. But I would say also, especially as I've advanced politically, it's been very important for me to not be typecast as a one-issue candidate. The issue that brought me to politics is health care. And, in fact, that's what I'm going to be addressing the convention on tomorrow.
Let's talk about your speech. What is it that you want to say?
Well, I really want to make the case for the fact that there's a tremendous difference between our current president and John Kerry on the health care issue.
As you well know, the Bush campaign has already been criticizing Mr. Kerry's plans. They say on the Bush website, and they cite the RAND Corporation, that 18 million Americans would lose employee-sponsored health coverage under Kerry's children's health program. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, it's outrageous that we have the wealthiest country in the world, and we have so many children right now who lack health care coverage at all. And I think the president ought to look at his own record before criticizing any other. Part of the mechanism that John Kerry wants to use in order to make sure that every child in America has coverage, period, is by expanding what's known as the S-CHIP program, the child health insurance program that's run by the states.
But how do you do that when the states are cash-strapped now?
Well, John Kerry proposes to fund his proposals, his whole proposal, not just the children's portion of it, by repealing the tax cuts that this president has given to the very wealthiest of American citizens, the top 2% of wage earners. And believe it or not, that would cover the entire Kerry health care plan.
Moving to another topic, what do you say to those on the right who say the Democrats made a mistake with their lineup this year, that instead of, as in the Clinton era, going to the middle, they went to the old left war horses like Mario Cuomo and Ted Kennedy, or the new left, you are an openly gay woman, and, you know, the far left in that aspect, and that the Republicans are going down the middle with McCain and Schwarzenegger and sending a different message and getting that important, perhaps, middle-of-the-country undecided vote?
Well, I actually think our lineup and the issues that people are going to be addressing during the convention are very representative of America and the concerns and anxieties that Americans have. And they really want to hear those issues addressed on the convention floor. Admittedly, I have not studied in detail the lineup for the Republican convention, but I can tell you I serve in the House of Representatives. And the Republicans are in control under the leadership of Tom DeLay. And the moderates that they're putting forward in the convention really aren't a reflection of the type of leadership that they have shown and the type of very conservative the policy that they've been touting in the House of Representatives and Senate.
We're listening to this group rehearse, and I just caught you looking around this room here. How are you feeling? This is going to be filled with thousands of people, and you're going to be talking to them.
Well, I just got butterflies when you said that, but actually, because I had such a busy week last week, I didn't have too much time to get nervous. I'm feeling very excited, very, very positive about the opportunity that I have tomorrow night.
I'm thinking my family in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, knows you very well. But you were telling me you tried to go through a door here, and they wouldn't let you through, ma'am.
Well, appropriately so. They were cordoning it off for a singing group on stage, and I'm very humble about those things. I'll wait my turn.
Tammy Baldwin represents Wisconsin's 2nd District. She'll be speaking to the Democratic National Convention tonight in the same primetime hour that includes Jimmy Carter, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton introducing her husband, Bill Clinton, and the finale by Patti LaBelle. Stay with us live from the Fleet Center. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
Depending on how you look at it, the party convened here in Boston to formally nominate John F. Kerry as its candidate for president has either won the last three presidential elections or won 2 out of 3 with a big asterisk by the one defeat. On this record, the Democratic Party would seem to still have a solid base in the country. But veteran observers aren't so sure about that. To look at the future of the party and preview the convention, we talk to Matt Bai, who is covering the convention for the New York Times Magazine and whose cover story in this week's issue assesses the state of the party. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, nice to be here.
Also joining us is political analyst, veteran convention watcher, and web blogger Bob Summerby, whose daily website, Daily Howler, is always worth a look. Hello, Bob.
Good day.
Okay, Matt, let me turn to you first. The cover story in this week's New York Times Magazine talks about a Democratic Party that has no central ideological vision, seems to slug along from one election to the next, and that it's losing momentum and support because of that.
You make it sound awfully glum, Michael.
Well, you know something? There is the sense that, you know, whatever it is ideologically that kept the Democratic Party together, that has dissipated, and a central core of energy does seem to be missing.
I think that's absolutely true. I think anybody who says otherwise may be saying it for public consumption, but it's pretty widely held belief, even among Democratic leaders who are thinking about these issues. You have essentially two distinct movements within the Democratic Party, neither of which has developed a whole lot of momentum or vision. You have sort of the traditional left base of the party, which really dominated Democratic politics for half a century and dominated Congress. And then I think you have this centrist, you know, what people consider the Clinton wing, which really goes back to Gary Hart and, you know, a movement that began in the early 80s and in the 90s, which promised to modernize, revitalize the party, but which in effect has become largely strategic and tactical. It's all about moving to the center to get these voters or get those voters, but they seem to have lost touch with the central conceit of centrism, which was to find a new ideological vision.
I don't know if anyone exactly has an ideological vision. The Republican Party certainly has more bumper stickers. I think it's hard to look at their performance, though, and think that their performance reflects their alleged ideological vision. And some of that ideological vision is just silly bumper stickers. Low taxes, well, everyone's basically in favor of low taxes. It'll be interesting to see what vision Kerry tries to drop on the party this Thursday night.
Well, what are you anticipating?
Well, I hear he's going to say strong at home, respected abroad. I mean, that's a couple of nice bumper stickers. And I think what he's really saying is we're not crazy. The other guy is. And, I'll say this for the Democratic Party. They've been struggling for a message, but they have still won the popular vote in three straight presidential elections despite those problems. So if they ever get a message, they're going to be unstoppable.
Matt, do you buy that idea that basically they're just coming out with a message that will fit on the bottom of your car?
In terms of them winning three straight popular votes, and that's one way to look at it, and it's the way a lot of Democrats would prefer to. I would add that, you know, in 1992, they had the extreme aid of Ross Perot. In 1996, they had the aid of the Republican Party. And in 2000, they should have had the aid of the best economic moment in the last century and still barely won the popular vote. So there's a couple ways to look at that. I do think this respected at home, respected abroad, strong at home, respected security, future of America's children. I mean, we've just heard this stuff. You know, all the words are interchangeable to me, and I don't mean to be overly cynical about it, but I do think this is how the public hears it, too. These slogans, not only are they sort of empty slogans at the end of the day, but they've been used, overused, rejiggered, reconfigured.
You know. Matt, I don't mean to interrupt you, but which comes first, the slogans or the way the media covers the politics and the politicians figure out that the slogan is the easiest thing to get through the media filter?
Well, I don't really buy that. I understand the argument, but sometimes we forget in sort of bashing the messenger, which is easy to do, that the media goes out every day and covers what it's given. You know, when the guy goes out and gives the same speech with no specifics and no program day after day after day, you end up getting a lot of horse race coverage and slogan coverage because there's not a lot else to write about what's happening on the campaign trail.
Let me stress that I wouldn't be blaming the media for this. I just think that you have two big national parties trying to appeal to a big national electorate. One party wants the top tax rate to be 39%, and one wants it to be 35%, and they pretend there's some sort of difference of kind there. There isn't a difference of kind. There's just minor differences of degree. And I just don't think either party really has some big ideological story that is really consistent with what they do.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, in this respect, I disagree with Bob a little bit. All the things you can say about George W. Bush, and you can say many, and it's hard to say that he hasn't had a bold vision over the last 4 years and a direction for the country in terms of foreign and domestic policy to probably a greater extent than any I can think of. John Kerry is testing the premise as he goes into the convention this week that you don't really have to meet some new test of new vision or new philosophy if the president himself is unpopular or controversial enough, that essentially to be elected as an alternative to this president, that all he really has to do is clear a bar of acceptability. And it's going to be interesting from my perspective to see when he comes in and gives his speech on Thursday night whether that is the bar to which they aspire.
Do you think anybody actually wants a vision?
I don't think people in general are searching for a vision. Indeed, people want jobs, they want a good economy, and they don't want to be at war. I think to the extent that George Bush claimed to have a vision, a lot of what he's done completely contradicts what he claimed to have as his vision. So I just don't see anything that rises to that level.
There are other people, though, besides John Kerry, who's going to you know, close things on Thursday. Do you anticipate any awkwardness, for example, when the Clintons speak tonight?
I certainly think there's a reason the Clintons are speaking on Monday night and early in the convention, and that's to get them out of the way because they take the attention and the limelight away from a candidate who's, to this point, been very little defined in the public mind.
I think the party is going to be thrilled with Clinton, and Clinton does a good job of expressing the vision of the Democratic Party, the extent that it exists. So, I mean, I think I would assume he will do a very good job in the room.
What does John Kerry need to do this week?
The one thing he might have going for him is that a lot of people haven't seen him, and he's been the subject of a lot of negative ad. Kerry may come in from some voters this Thursday night with low expectations, and he may strike them as, hey, this guy's not bad. If he can say to them, look at me, I'm smart, I'm strong, I'm sensible, I'll keep you safe, he may look a lot better to a lot of voters than what they've been hearing in this battle of the ads.
Matt Bai, what do you think?
Smart and strong and sensible is all good, but I actually think it really would do John Kerry a lot of good if he came off as likable on top of all those things. I think it's pretty clear that American people tend to vote with their gut. There's a vote out there that's going to break late in a lot of these key states, and I think a real bar for John Kerry is whether people feel like they like and trust him on a very visceral level. That's where a lot of politics is.
Maybe he should kiss Al Gore's wife. What do you say?
Well, that would certainly spice things up a bit from what we're going to get.
That's right.
I'll leave you, Bob Somerby, with your vivid imagination.
All right.
And thank you, too, Matt Bai.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Michael.
Matt Bai is covering the Democratic Convention for the New York Times Magazine. And Bob Somerby continues to write about politics every day at dailyhowler.com.
Still to come, what happened when filmmaker Michael Moore stepped onto the convention floor today?
You are listening to Here and Now. You can't have a convention without delegates. There are 4,353 attending the Democratic Convention here in Boston, along with 611 alternates. And we wondered just what a delegate does in an age where the crucial business of the convention, nominating a candidate, is done long before the party actually meets. So Here and Now headed out to Boston's Logan International Airport and joined the local welcoming committee to find out.
Hello, this is Governor Mitt Romney. Welcome to Massachusetts, and thank you for choosing Logan International Airport. Our Commonwealth is rich in history.
Don Wolford, I'm a volunteer for the city of Boston, and today we're greeting some of the delegates that arrived by aircraft and pointing them to the right direction for local transportation to the hotels and wherever else they may go.
Welcome to Boston.
Thank you. Kurt Allen, good to meet you. Chicago.
Kurt, pleasure meeting you. Don Wolford.
Thanks for welcoming us.
I'm Kurt Elling from Chicago, and I'm representing the 2nd Congressional District of Illinois as a delegate to the Democratic Convention. I was active in the Kerry campaign before Iowa. I happened to get a call from David Wilhelm, who is the chair of the Illinois campaign for Kerry, a little bit later on, asking if I'd be interested in running as a delegate. And I was very interested because it's a great opportunity to learn what it's like to be on the inside and to give what I can. I'm a jazz singer, and I also have an agenda in my role as vice chairman of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. We have some meetings scheduled with congressmen and with senators about copyright law and things that affect recording artists. So I'll be doing some things for them. I'm doing I'll be doing some music for Terry McAuliffe on Monday, and former President Clinton will be there. I'm very excited about that. And I've called a bunch of great players from here in town, and we'll play for an hour, and we'll be drowned out by a sea of people talking politics, and that'll be fun. And then, I don't know, I've signed up. There's a discussion among a number of very top-level brain people talking about the Iraq situation and where that might be headed. So I try to sign up for as much as I can to get what the smart people are thinking. I'm just happy to be here.
Our producer, April Peavy, will be following the convention through the eyes of Illinois delegate and jazz musician Kurt Elling throughout the week.
Well, for months, one of the biggest pre-convention stories here in Boston has been the expected commuter problems. But those same news stories provoked most travelers to stay home or leave. While the Kerry motorcade reportedly had a very small accident this morning, most of the commute was smooth, some commuter lines reporting as much as 70% fewer riders. But this afternoon at 4, full security measures kick in. The major railway station under the convention center, now housing the foreign press, has no trains running. And Interstate 93, the main north-south highway, which cuts through the heart of Boston and is a stone's throw from the Fleet Center, will be closed. Thank goodness the Red Sox won 2 out of 3 with the Yankees this weekend, because otherwise things could get really ugly.
Just past Cheers, no place to park. Taking laps till way past dark. Underpass, overhead. I'd be better off if I had stayed in bed. Oh, yeah.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Time.
Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
The Democratic Convention is a star-studded event, but the worlds of politics and entertainment collided a long time ago. The movie industry has always been aware of the importance of lobbying to its financial well-being. That's why 38 years ago, the Motion Picture Association of America hired Lyndon Johnson's then press secretary, Jack Valenti, to be chairman, or chief lobbyist. Jack Valenti is finally retiring, and in September, another Politico, Dan Glickman, a former Kansas congressman and current head of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, will replace him. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea sat down with Dan Glickman in his Harvard office, no swimming pool attached, to discuss the issues ahead.
The biggest challenge the movie industry faces is the same kind of challenge the music industry has faced, which is illegal copying of content.
Now, you're a Democrat. You were under the Clinton administration as the Secretary of Agriculture. Your party affiliation could be a hurdle for you, and some have threatened consequences for the MPAA if this role was filled by a Democrat.
Well, First of all, this is a nonpartisan job. I was Secretary of Agriculture for 6 years. The Department of Agriculture was probably the most nonpartisan agency within our government, and I worked as well with Republicans as I did with Democrats, and I intend to do the same thing here.
But culture issues and culture wars are partisan, and films, obviously, especially in a year like this year with Fahrenheit 9/11, you're jumping in at a pretty crazy time.
But most issues still are not partisan. And in addition, this industry is responsible for hundreds of thousands of jobs. And those jobs are in lots of congressional districts, Republicans and Democrats. So, yeah, I know that right now, at least, the administration, both houses of Congress are Republican, but I expect to reach out and work with them just as well as I'd work with Democrats.
So what do you think of the current climate, this kind of intensified relationship that we have right now between entertainment and politics with, Whoopi Goldberg speaking out against President Bush and all the controversy that came out of that, Fahrenheit 9/11 again? What do you think of the climate right now?
Well, most of these statements have occurred by performers. And, they deserve the right to have freedom of speech. I don't necessarily agree with everything that came out. I, for example, saw Fahrenheit 9/11 and I thought that while it was interesting entertainment, it was not entirely the fairest movie I've ever seen. But it's the First Amendment right of people to do whatever they want to do. And we've always had that. Since the Second World War up into the present time, entertainers and performers have always expressed their views. And some are conservative, more are liberal, but it doesn't reflect the agenda of the industry, which is basically to continue to produce this creative content.
Although there does seem to be a heightened sense of, I'm not going to say fear, but there is something there, like Walt Disney being reluctant to distribute Michael Moore's film. There's a reluctance, I think, to be associated with films when they raise political themes.
Well, but the system is resilient enough, so if one studio doesn't want to do something, another studio usually comes in. It would be a serious problem if we operated within a chilling environment where people did not feel comfortable doing this kind of thing. And so even in a situation like we have now where one political party controls the presidency in both houses of Congress, you still have the belief that free expression is critical. And I don't see anything dramatically challenging that, but we do have to be vigilant about it.
Now, Jack Valenti created the rating system, and this is another point of controversy for a lot of people in the industry as well as parents. A recent Harvard study found that the ratings don't accurately reflect the levels of violence and sex in the movies. They've been called inconsistent, arbitrary even. What specifically are you going to do to address these concerns?
Well, again, I don't take the job till September the 1st, so I can't comment specifically on what I'm going to do. I personally think the rating system, by and large, has worked pretty well, but it doesn't mean it doesn't need to be reviewed.
Now, Jack Valenti, last year he made a decision. He didn't want DVDs and videos to be released for Oscar-nominated films for the judges. This outraged independent filmmakers. The MPAA represents mainly the major studios. But what are you going to do to build relationships with and work with the independents?
That's a good question. And I have an obligation to try to develop relationships with a lot of people in this business, not just the major studios who are the members of MPAA, but the directors, the writers, the independent film producers, the theater owners, consumers. I mean, there are a lot of people who are very much involved in the movie industry. And one of my, I think one of my strengths is I'm a pretty good bridge builder and a consensus builder, and I'll try to do that.
Here and now's Andrea Shea speaking with Dan Glickman, former Democratic congressman and future chairman of the Motion Picture Association of America. As we said, one of the films that's stirring up controversy in Hollywood and Washington is Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, which crossed the $100 million mark in box office receipts this past weekend. Moore is in Boston. Where else would he be? Robin Young is at the Fleet Center, where there was a Moore sighting.
Yes, there was, Michael. He appeared on the floor today, and a media scrum immediately formed around him. We thought we'd just let our listeners listen in on a little.
What role will your movie play in the outcome of the election, do you think?
I have no idea. I know from the surveys they've done that a lot of people who've gone to the movie, especially independents and swing voters, aren't swinging by the time they walk out of the movie theater. It's even the GOP, I read the story in the Associated Press last week, the GOP consultants were saying that they now have to pay attention to this movie because too many independents and swing voters are walking out of the movie and deciding they're not going to vote for George W. Bush.
Do you consider Kerry an anti-war candidate, Mr. Moore?
Absolutely, yes.
Really?
Yes.
So he says he'll keep the troops there indefinitely and maybe
No. The way I would define it is I do not believe that John Kerry ever would have invaded the sovereign nation of Iraq, a country that was run by a brutal dictator, but nonetheless was not a threat to the United States. And he will not do what George W. Bush did. I think everybody knows that. And that is the major, major difference.
Michael, do you think the Iraqi people are better off, albeit the reason for getting into the war, if the Iraqi people are nonetheless better off with Saddam Hussein and his sons out of there?
Well, yeah, that's just a given. We're also better off if the sun rises in the east and stays up there for a good, 12 hours a day. But what's the point?
Well, I guess the point is that the Iraqi people might be a little bit better off, albeit that it was a...
I'll name 30 other countries with dictators that would be better off if their dictators are gone. Is your point...
Did George Bush go after them?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is the point, we should invade 30 other countries? I don't think any American would support that. That is not the reason he took us to war. He took us to war because he said there were weapons of mass destruction that were an imminent threat to you and I, and that Saddam was connected with al-Qaeda and had something to do with September 11th. And those things proved not to be true.
Michael, John Kerry has asked that delegates and the attendees not bash Bush this week, that the tone be positive. How are you going to handle that?
You don't need to bash Bush. All you got to do is repeat the facts. Largest deficit ever, from the largest surplus ever, a loss of millions of jobs, a war that was concocted for false reasons. Just all you have to do is state the facts. You don't have to get personal with George W. Bush. You just have to show what's happened, and I think that's a good message. I think that's what the American people will respond to. Look. The Democrats are only going to win this if they have the courage of their convictions. And I think you have a very different Democratic Party than you had 4 years ago. You have a very different Al Gore than you had 4 years ago. And I think that you're not going to see a weak-kneed, a wimpy response to what's happened in the last 3.5 years from the White House. And just because they're being polite here, polite's a good thing. I'm polite. If you've really seen my movies, I'm right. I obviously have very strong convictions, but I think you should behave that way. That's the way our side is. Our side isn't, like the other side. These people are, I don't know what they eat for breakfast, but
what about Mr. Hines' comment to a reporter to shove it? Was that polite?
As long as it was to a reporter, yeah.
Michael Moore, filmmaker Michael Moore, holding court really on the floor of the Fleet Center earlier today.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.